The stories say Mexicans grew out of the dirt, same as the corn stalks. Of course, we weren't Mexicans back then. Whatever we were was lost. No, not lost. Submerged under empire, died by blood and gunpowder. Believe what you want. Maybe we grew out of the dirt. Maybe agave is our sibling. Maybe mountains our mother. The oldest tradition I know is watching my dad bet money on Mexican boxers, no matter the odds. I don't know about y'all, but I'm the child of loss and the inheritor of losing. I'm not complaining though. I know the tradition. I bet everything I have on my people and dare the universe to beat us.
And welcome back to Literally Literary. If this is your first time joining us, be sure to check out our previous episodes. This episode, we are beginning our discussion on Promises of Gold by Jose Olivares. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the first five sections of the collection.
Nice. We're back.
We're back. You have to say the...
Oh. No, I'm scared. Okay, guys. We're back.
Did you miss us?
Because we missed you.
There we go. That's for all you TikTokers out there.
Check mark.
Up until 20 minutes ago, I had no idea what that was.
Yeah.
But it's so funny.
It is funny.
Shout out to Vanessa for teaching us the ways.
Thanks for sharing.
Hey, you're welcome.
The Gen Z lingo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we started off the episode with a little snippet of Jose Olivares himself reading...
Tradition
mm-hmm. from his visit to El Paso last year
in April,
which was a treat. Yay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was a really cool visit because he performed at the open mic through the, you know, Richie's Barbwire open mic. And then before that, he did the book signing and the reading at EPCC Valle Verde's campus. And there's a recording of it if you guys want to check it out that we can link in the, what do they call it?
The show notes.
Show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's on YouTube, the Barbed Wire Open Mic YouTube. You can just type in Jose Olivares, Paso Community College. Talks a bit about coming up with the book. He presented a new book to that project that he had worked on, right, with his photographer friend, and then some Q&A mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. students and mm-hmm. instructors. So it's cool. It's cool to go back and... Yeah. I guess this episode then has been a long time coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost a year since his visit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to let good art ruminate.
Let it simmer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even before that, of course, you know, you all might be familiar with Citizen Illegal that we also had covered way back, you know, 3-4 years ago, whenever that was.
In the beginning.
Well, I was thinking we started going over that during the pandemic because I remember being already in quarantine, which is interesting because that's when he was writing this book, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
There's a time confluence there. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ever since then, we wanted to bring Jose over, so we were really happy that we were able to make that happen. But yeah, you know, hope you guys check out the recording there. And if you were there, you know, it was, I'm sure you can... you can chime in, you know, because some of us have actually taught Jose's books in our classes too. So you might have already read this because of that.
And some of you are currently reading Jose's book, my class. We're reading Citizen Illegal, but trying to find a way to include Promises of Gold or at least some of the poetry in here as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, students are always really receptive to Jose's voice, his themes. So it's been really nice kind of introducing him mm-hmm. to students and for them to resonate with a lot of what he has to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So today we're going to look at the first five sections of Promises of Gold.
Yes.
Before we get into specifics, do you all have, I guess, overall feelings, thoughts, reactions? I guess I'll go first. I felt like this one had a lot to do with like music being healing and healing through music, which his other collection was super heavy with music. But this one talked about music in a little bit of a different way, and how it works to heal. So I thought that was interesting.
Nice, yeah. I like the way he just talks about this collection acting like in waves, you know, and it's a pretty nice, such a poetic way, right? I'm describing even that. That plus talking about how when we hear the word love and love poetry, people tend to immediately attach it to the romantic, and how in this instance he's kind of deconstructing that and all other sorts of love, family love, familial love, love for the homies. I really love how those are present, and that was that definitely encapsulated some of those moments during the quarantine where human interaction was so vital, you know, and keeping that, even if it was through a Zoom call, phone call, whatever. I think he captured some of those moments really well. And then lastly, you know, love also kind of being able to deconstruct something like colonialism, patriarchy. And he mentions that, right, amidst the global pandemic, laying wake to all the other ones we lived through. And he, that's in his author's note at the very beginning. So capitalism is a pandemic. The police state is pandemic. Colonialism is a pandemic. Toxic masculinity is a pandemic. I just wrote a big star next to that. Yes. All right.
The other thing is the cover. You know, this is one of my favorite covers. And just like your shirt there, Richie, the Luchador, right?
Yep. Totally did that on purpose.
I actually like this cover a little more than the Citizen Illegal. And the other thing, you know, before we get started on the first section, is the translation. And if you guys follow José Olivares on his social media, he posted a video a while back when his book first came out, explaining why he included the Spanish version. And especially, you know, those of you who are teachers, I think this would be really useful for the classroom, because now you can teach both poems, the English and the Spanish version, like I do, and then kind of, you know, analyze some of the differences. And, you know, the translator here has his own note explaining how he came about, you know, deciding some of those lexical choices that he made. But that's what I'm going to try to do here in our conversation today is, you know, I'll be covering some of the Spanish versions of the poems.
And that's another unique element of the book, too, the way it was set up, where if you flip it over, right, it's now it's like reading it the normal way, right? Because normally sometimes if a collection is translated, they're usually side by side, page by page, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this is a very interesting way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Changes your experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So should we get into the sections?
Part one.
And he also talks about naming the sections. So he has folk tales, ojalá, 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 bold, untranslatable, and receding as the first five sections. And then there's some repetition in the last ones as well. So we're starting with folk tales. And you all already heard Tradition, which is the first poem in. No notes on that one?
I mean, it's a great piece. Like, so I think that's a good reason to start off the podcast today. Because he read it and I recorded it. But I think it's a great throw. Shout out to the ancestors. It's another thing that he talks about frequently, and just this kind of culture of resistance. It's also something that he brings up all throughout his colonialism, right? Kind of referencing that, right? Mm-hmm. Our people, and kind of ending with this. Triumphant, you know, I dare you, you know, to beat us. Like, we're resilient, we're gonna keep fighting. And that's what art is too. Being a poet.
I mean, that reminds me of what's that the modernist poet, the Do I Dare Disturb the Universe?
T.S. Eliot.
Yeah. This is my favorite poem from the first chapter also. So it was great to see Jose perform it live for us. And in Spanish, you know, the line is, le apuesto todo lo que tengo a mi gente y reto al universo a que nos venza. Yeah, I really like that kind of the roots that set this up, you know, set up the collection. Because in the first book, you know, we also get the Citizen Illegal as the eponymous poem that opens that collection. And so I think he's really doing a great job of these strong, you know, this is like Korn's Blind to me, you know, really great opening track, so to speak, going back to your, you know, the music connection that you see. So yeah, it's great.
Cool.
I really like the recurring image of boxing and his father and like those traditions and memories that he holds that resonate with me because I have similar memories of watching my dad watch boxing or football. So there's a lot of that and just what tradition means to us and what we hold as important or even holy, right? He gets into later. In different poems, so things that we might not consider or know what they are in the moment, but then in retrospect really see how valuable they are.
Yeah, it's a little tie back to Citizen Illegal, right? Because that's very prominent throughout as well.
Stood out in this first session.
Ooh.
I like 12, unless someone has one before that. Age 16 after Lucille Clifton. First, because, you know, I love Lucille Clifton's work too. And it's really cool to see a poet, you know, anytime he's writing something with another poet in mind, like it's always interesting to see those connections and that inspiration. So I really liked this one because it's one of those like in your face poems. Like I made it into Harvard and still like discussing the discrimination, the prejudice, the having to prove yourself to everyone, even though you got in rightfully and deserve to be there 100% like everybody else. But there's still those, you know, having that having to prove yourself. I love a few lines, you know, now I make poems in languages they can't register. Feel me? In every poem, I hide garden shears, you know, so kind of that play on him being seen as like going to Harvard to mow the lawns, you know, in the first lines of the poem. But now there's like this, you know, aggressiveness, I guess, in the second half of the poem. José el poeta y José the gardener. I like that part too. Each of us biting our tongues, trying to make beauty grow from soil covering bones barely under the surface. So, you know, José being able to be both, claiming and reclaiming and showing what he's capable of. And yeah, I just really like the message in this one.
Yeah, something he does all throughout with like his title is also asking us, what is wealth? In this instance, right? What is God? What is glory? What is gold? Kind of inverting that conquest kind of language. Yeah, this also kind of ties into some of the ones we read. And so this is an illegal, his experience in Harvard. And, you know, even within like other, he says Latinx people, right? Seeing that they come from different backgrounds too, not exactly so. But this one hit really well, and I like how he ties it to José el Poeta and José the Gardener, and both turning their heads at their name and growing beauty from soil. And I think that's the wealth right there, right? Voila. What did you guys have for the second section? I'm sure everyone got out to tortilla, right?
We all have sticky notes on this
one. This one, yeah. We got a preview on. If you followed him on Twitter, I remember him posting, like, working on this.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's another thing of reading contemporary poets, you know, if you're following them on social media, like, they'll post little things here and there. And I do remember reading this one off of Twitter, or formerly Twitter, ex-formerly Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, this is one of the ones that I teach in my class. And so, you know, definitely one of my favorites overall. And I think it's a good, for the teachers out there, it's a good reading to teach students about how to write their own poems. You know, I think as much as important as it is to expose them to poets, I think, you know, we also should teach students about the importance of finding their voice within the poems that they read. And so just teaching them about odes, I think, is great. And of course, you can, you know, reference the tradition of the ode, famous odes. I always mention the Watcher from Netflix as the ode to the house. And, you know, so many odes out there that students, I think this is a very, almost a very natural poem for them to write as in honor of something.
Yeah, I agree. I love all of Jose's odes, and he has several in Citizen Illegal. And then I include this one as well, Ode to Tortillas, just because it's great. And yeah, my students love it. And they love that idea of being able to write an honor poem or a praise poem or things that maybe, you know, more unconventional topics. So I always have them, you know, make sure that they pick a topic that's not, you know, that's a little more unconventional. So I've had students write odes to memes, odes to bacon. What did they do? They just did these like 2 weeks ago. That's why they're so fresh in my mind. Ode to a Rainy Day. That one was a little more. But yeah, so they really appreciate the style and that you can have fun with it, you know, and that it doesn't have to be so precious, you know, the style of the ode.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, one of the things I really enjoy about Jose's collection is that he does kind of play a lot with, you know, what an ode can be and even the topics that he writes about. He'll write about God, but he doesn't write about God in a sacred way always. He's like, well, maybe God should stop making jokes, and you know, he'll take away the which some people might be like, oh, that's sacrilegious. But if you're not seeing it that way, you're appreciating what he's doing with it. I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, Jose definitely has some really great odes that celebrate. And this one is just a big celebration, right? Not just the tortilla, but like Mexican experience, Mexican American experience, and even has a little bit of a joke there at the end. Yeah, how his children, he's gonna like, you know, praise the tortilla, and they're probably gonna want McDonald's, which I think is that just that jab of again capitalism and maybe always that gap between generations, you know, between wanting to become more. And that symbol of like wanting McDonald's being more entrenched in American consumerism.
Just kind of going off that, in the Spanish translation, I know that in the English one, you know, it refers to like non-existent cousins, right? And I think that's a really good line because it shows the, you know, the playfulness that Jose uses and the voice of the speaker. Being lighthearted, you know, the bougie cousins in the original, here in the Spanish version, it says, puedes comerlas con tenedor y cuchillo, como lo hacen mis primos los muy muy. ¿Qué primos los muy muy? You know, and so the translator really does a great job of capturing like that very unique phrase, right? Muy muy, which all of us, you know, I think can be familiar with.
That sold me on going back and reading the Spanish translation.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And then my favorite line, though, was the, my people, I am poly with the tortillas, which in Spanish, you know, he spells out poliamoroso, which is interesting. But just kind of that, like, Mexicans kind of just, at the end of the day, I mean, we eat it if it, if we're hungry, you know?
Yeah.
It's a multi-purpose food.
Yeah.
You can have it so many different ways. And,
I think this is one that's really fun to read out loud as well. Just like the language of it. And it's so tactile that it just brings us there.
Yeah, I think discussing this under imagery is what I do. And so it lets me talk a little bit about the five different kinds of taste that we have. You know, sweet, salty, bitter, umami, and forget the fifth one was, but yeah, because you kind of get all five here from, and you see the way that the tortilla can be so diverse because of that.
There's two ways to be a Mexican writer. You can translate from Spanish, or you can translate to Spanish. I like that. Or you can refuse to translate altogether. And there's a lot of poems in this collection that bring up translation and language and how it can be seen as traitorous, and which has always been a conversation. But I appreciate that too, seeing as how this collection was translated and all the nuances and intricacies with those choices that were being what had just mentioned.
Yeah, there's like that almost like Deadpoolian nature of like the poet, this, the line referring to itself and how it's going to be translated. Did you guys have another one from this section? Or
I like the regret one. I don't know if you guys have that one.
What page is that?
27.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, you talk about different types of love poems, right? In this one, he talks about this universe, right? In another world, his dad could have stayed at the bar and, you know, flirting with everyone. And such an interesting thing to imagine your parents doing, right? But I like the comparison here at the end, right? Like, it's easy to daydream about love when it's about a chorus of kisses. What about when love is a dirty diaper and a snot nose? My dad rarely said love, but he always left the bar. It's an interesting way of acknowledging, like, you know, his actions. He didn't, never said about love, you know. I guess in that sense, I think of King Lear, right? You know, having to do, like, is saying love the same as, like, acting on love, you know? Cordelia, Shakespeare, man, refused to say love, right? Like, no, you know I love you, right? And so anyway, here I just like how he acknowledges that. His dad in this instant, right? It's like he always left the bar.
I was just going to say, this reminds me of, and I had to look it up because I can't remember the poet, but Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays. How in that one, you know, you get the father who's getting up very early to, you know, start the fire, and it's really cold out there. So, like, he's, you know, he's got, like, callous hands from all the manual labor. And how the poet there is reflecting on how, you know, that was the form of love for the father that, you know, he refers to in closing as like love's austere offices. And so this kind of reminds me of this, because we do see Jose's father, well, the speaker's father, you know, throughout the connection, and just the ways that he is showing his love.
All right.
Are we moving on to part three now?
Yeah.
Okay.
That first one's that example of a poem, right? The title leading into the poem.
Yeah, and if anyone knows what that's called, let us know. Yeah, I love when poems do that. Just go right into the first line and immediacy of it, the rhythm of it. It's very cool.
It really helps also when they're performing it.
Another father's poem on 35. Kind of sticky on this one, and just I guess the way in which he talks about fathers, and then it's he's kind of alluding that it's a general fathers, but then the poem is like his father there. It's true, my dad stopped hugging me, but I never said the other part. I stopped hugging him too. And then those basement parties where the men would drink and then drink some more, they only sang when they were drunk, they only hugged when they sang, they only cried when they hugged. And that's how the poem ends. I really like that, just, you know, showing that different kind of love, like you were talking about, Richie, and but also the machismo that comes with Mexican fathers, particularly, and how alcoholism just brings that out.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So, and this comes up a few other times, so it's not just like, that's what I'm getting from this poem, but... the other times of, like, you know, like even the poem that you just referenced, Regret, and how it's not often vocalized, you know, like, I love you, or, but the fathers are working the jobs or doing the thing, you know, acting out their love for their families. And then for their brothers in very different ways, their homies in very different ways.
And I don't know if you guys picked up on 37, the reference to Alan that you guys covered, right? Pianata theory. And then Kim, who's also, you know, another poet that I really recommend as well. So you get a little Bay poem there.
the poem right before that, an almost sonnet for my mom's almost life, reminds me a lot. And just because we've been reading Citizen Illegal on my mom's 50th birthday. Do you all remember that poem?
No.
It has similar themes. So this is for my mom's almost life, right? And he talks about in the life where my mom never has kids, she doesn't mourn. She spends her 20s following Marco Antonio Solís show to show, hands up and surrender in praise to a different God than the one she spends Sundays kneeling to now. I love imagining her like this. So it just goes on about like what could have been, right, in a different life. Mother, and in that other poem, it's kind of the same thing. On my mother's 50th birthday, you know, she dresses up, she goes out with her sisters, and on that birthday she's out with her lipstick and men are looking at her and they don't know she's a mother. She's not worrying about the kids in that moment. She's just living her life as if she was a different person. So it's kind of a nice call back to that too, and I really like that idea of in a way Jose through these poems I feel like is praising his mother too, and showing us that we should also try to imagine our mothers as something other than that, like that's not their only role in our lives.
Exactly.
A lot of us, myself included.
Yeah, I really like that that whole reimagining, right? And that image at the end, I absolutely like puts it together of her stirring her coffee cup, a coffee mug with her eyes closed and a slight smile that's just her smile, like hers. And yeah, it brings to life again, love for his mother, but in the role where she's not his mother, you know, and I think that's a nice tribute too. An almost sonnet for my mom's almost life. Like it, because it's almost a sonnet, but nah. Very nice. There's this quarantine poem. Remember when we first read Maurice Carlos Ruffin's new book of short stories, right? That was one of the first instances where we were reading about the pandemic and quarantine. And I remember. So I kind of remember him sharing this part of this too, right? At the end of this section, it's only day whatever of the quarantine, and I'm already daydreaming about robbing rich people. What a title.
Yeah. Just like that first line, I would like to punch Jeff Bezos in his stupid face.
Yeah, I actually got to see him read this one on a Zoom reading that he had. So cool. Before the book came out, so it was really great to see it live. And yeah,
I think that's definitely one of those ones that does work with the reading, because it's supposed to have an impact. It's supposed to have an effect. And I mean, really, it's just that anxiety we had during the pandemic and kind of being fed up with, I mean, not having healthcare, access to healthcare. And something he talks about is not being able to see his parents, you know, and we all kind of felt that isolation and that frustration. So it makes sense, right? Because he even makes this point where he's like, is this a good poem? It's not a good poem. I just want healthcare. It's not pretty.
Yeah.
I like how he does follow it up with a poem with a little less aggression. That's great.
Have you all read Kim Adonisio?
I've read some of hers, yeah.
Yeah, she's really good. I've only read Akowski in a Sundress, his collection. One of her collections. Enjoyed that.
A lot of these poems in this section relate to, you know, the class struggle, right? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you start to see that thread. Even like, there's a mall one where they can't afford anything, just the food, but that's what they wanted anyway. Like that's. The card decline definitely hits well on that. Like,
And I like also the playing with the form, right? With the page 43, the poem that is a text from his brother, which we also see later on.
Little class in this book. I love that.
Yeah, I like that too. Only, if only because it's kind of showing us that poetry can be anything, you know. Sometimes we find it in places we wouldn't expect, like a text message exchange.
Yeah, I mean, it points to that again, class struggle, where it's like you imagine yourself maybe going up a bracket and you are immediately start thinking of all the things you're gonna, like, healthcare, yeah, I'm gonna get my teeth strained, I'm gonna do this and do that. It's just, you know, it's just kind of this thing where he's maybe getting his text like, this is a poem right here. I get that all the time.
Canelo. So really, you know, the difference here of like poetry is everywhere. You know, you don't have to have a MFA to be a poet. And I think that's one of the big differences, you know, with poetry than other art forms, written art forms at least. Did any of you have anything before 47?
Oh yeah, this one. I guess no.
So this one, you know, is another one that I teach, and I actually pair it up with La Migra by Pat Mora. And this is actually my favorite poem from the entire collection. You know, it really, of course, hits close to home. I really like how it contrasts with a poem like La Migra, where, you know, Border Patrol is in pursuit of a migrant woman. Whereas this one, you know, there's a kind of divine intervention, because through the power of the, as it's called here, the Dios del Chisme, they're able to avoid the ICE raid. And, you know, it's also, I think, a love poem, right? Love to family, familia, and, you know, love of like hardworking immigrants, of love of God. Even if this God is like a specific kind of God, right? You know, I really like the line in the middle there. Las mujeres dirían que... Oh, actually, maybe a little bit above. Entonces, cuando los oficiales de inmigración llegaron, encontraron cajas de calcetines y a todas las mujeres ausentes, seguras en casa. Aquellos oficiales pensaron que nadie estaba trabajando. Estaban equivocados. Las mujeres dirían que Dios estaba trabajando. Y ese era Dios. Aunque el Dios al que mi mamá nos enseñó a temer era vengativo. Él bien pudo mojarse el pulgar y borrar a la migra de este mundo con una mancha en espejo. Ese Dios era el Dios que me despertaba. And it goes on there, you know, but the kind of God that the speaker paints here, I really love. You know, because it is a God of migrants, a God that, you know, shows the love of his or her people that way. And through the idea of like the chisme, you know, something that has like a negative connotation in general, but here, I mean, it's something that is able to prevent them from being deported, despite the fact that, of course, like these are jobs that no one else really does. And you know, of course, this is part of America's contradictions.
Yeah, one of many. Well said. Love that. I love the idea of a God of Chisme. And he gives a shout out to Chisme as well in his author's note introduction there. Something that we kind of love to do, you know. As my friend Kit Rand likes to say in one of his poems, the Chisme Industrial Complex.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the si Dios quiere, and gracias a Dios, gracias, that he has. And that's something that's so also like truly prevalent, you know, the if it's God's will kind of thing. And Jorge was mentioning the divine intervention towards the end of the poem is gracias a Dios, but not the Dios that we grew up with or that we are imagining, but a new God. Very cool.
I mean, it's a counter narrative in that way, right? Because like we're used to seeing so many poems that are tragic, and you know, I mentioned La Migra, but even with narratives, of course, right? There's a lot of stories where they, you know, the powers that be, the, you know, the government, and you know, founded on like these white supremacist ideas that. Just because, you know, you're Mexican or like you're not, you know, Caucasian, you're going to be at risk, right? And so you're going to be living precariously in this factory that is making things that we all need. So I like that, you know, referencing in the title that this is something perhaps ideal, but perhaps also possible, right? I mean, this is something that might happen.
Yeah. Next one is 58. So,
I don't have any for this section.
54 for me, Vanessa. Okay.
60.
Six. So chapter 4, right, is intraducible, untranslatable. 34. I mean, 54 to me, you know, is another one that hits close to home here because of NAFTA. you know, those of us who are old enough to remember, I guess just three of us here.
Okay. Not to exclude anybody.
You know, in 1994, we remember that because of this, like, the Maquilas ended up suffering. And so there was a lot of backlash, you know, against Clinton and the signing of NAFTA. You know, so I think it's, you know, going back to the anti-capitalist view that this collection presents, I think it's another interesting way of kind of something that is almost like esoteric, right? Not a lot of people know about it, but still, you know, those of us here in the border, I think will be able to recognize, you know, especially like if we grew up in the Lower Valley like me, where, you know, you still see these trucks that are crossing over to Juarez from the Puente Libre, and this, you know, the free trade that ended up impacting not just Mexico, but, you know, Latin America and the global South because of how this affected agriculture. And so they weren't able to make as good of profits because of the free trade. Hmm. But, you know, just the opening, para levantarse antes que el sol, mi mamá tiene su rutina memorizada. So I like, you know, going back to La Familia there and just, you know, getting up before the sunrise.
Yeah. Also, I mean, Vanessa, you mentioned this idea of singing to heal, mm-hmm. right? And you have that kind of closing out this poem.
Yeah. Hmm. But singing, they sing the song their parents sung and grandparents sung and great-grandparents sung and great-great-grandparents sung. Buscamos dólares y solo encontramos dolores.
Yeah. Which in Spanish, of course, here, I mean, there's something to translate, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the alliteration there.
Mm-hmm. So kind of also in several poems throughout this section, it's kind of the reference to, like, love amongst the homies, right? And how it's hard, you know, like, the one right after that is about how they have to make a group thread, you know, or they play games online together, but still kind of, like, that's their way of keeping close without being close, you know? And I love the poem on 58. It's kind of a break from that. And it's I think it's very relatable. I think all of us have probably dealt with heartbreak in our lives, and to have that person there to help us through it. And his gratitude is so profound that it just struck me. This is probably one of my favorite throughout the entire collection. Ojalá, I hate heartbreak. And you know, he's going through this really tough break. The speaker's going through this tough breakup. And he called a homie a few blocks away. They held my hand all the way to my apartment. Oh, God, I praise this touch. Untranslatable, which is the name of the section, right? Which is how I know it's holy. So I like this idea of, like, being able to translate it. Like, but it's, you know, it's something special. It's holy. So I really love that poem, for sure.
Yeah.
The one before as well, La Poesía no es Terapia, you know, I think it says a lot for Jose here as a poet to be very open about men's mental health. And given that, of course, going back to what you said, Reina, about machismo, that a lot of times it's neglected, right? It's like not even spoken about. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting thinking about how he imagines that perhaps it is a kind of therapy.
Like that he does speak on these issues, because there was that other one in Citizen Illegal too. My therapist says to make friends with my monsters. Mm-hmm. That one hit well. And that's something that in preparing for this, I listened to interviews and he talks about how his friends, like, are more open now, or his brother's trying to actually write poetry and sending it to him and be more open with their feelings. So it's kind of cool to see that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that personally too, when I do all my community poetry stuff, you know, the meaning it has for so many people. And of course, my friend Lizliano, who is on the board of the Southwest New Mexico chapter of NAMI, which is for Institute of Mental Health.
Mm.
He's like, yes, art will help, but definitely go see a therapist too.
Yeah.
So the one I wanted to talk about is Healing on page 60.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's kind of just about, like, learning to love yourself and just, like, being there for being kinder to yourself, I think. So I really liked, like, the majority of the lines in this one. But especially, like, struggling with depression, just the idea of eating just feels like so much of a task sometimes. So I liked the lines, holding my own hand from meal to meal, all of it tasted the same, tacos and cake, I had to force myself to eat, to drink water. So just like this idea of like struggling even to do like some of the things that we would think are the simplest of tasks, you just feel like so much more of a bigger task when you're struggling mentally. And then the lines following, I was learning something about showing up. And then in the margin, I wrote for myself. Because I think, especially like when you are struggling with depression, you will show up for other people more than you'll show up for yourself, and consider it like you're healing. But a lot of the times it's not, because you haven't shown up for yourself enough to grow and move on. So I really like this one.
Yeah, again, probably really relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like the line in Spanish here, para que el dolor se disolviera como azúcar.
Yeah. Yes, we have the last section for this episode, that is, right? Mm-hmm. Five, receding.
What is it, receding? What's that in Spanish?
Retrocediendo.
I like authenticity.
Oh my God, I was just laughing at that one, rereading it. Too. Because it's magical, and it's so short and it's sweet, but it hits so hard.
And isn't this a reference also to a poem from Citizen Illegal about hot Cheetos or something, or?
Yes, I can't remember right now, but he did also, I think he read this one.
Yeah.
When we had him on the Zoom.
I do remember.
That year. Yeah.
So I want to ask you guys, what makes it an authentic Chicano love poem? Because he's deliberate in saying that, right? Mm-hmm. Is it because we all know the trope of the hot Cheetos? You gotta have the hot Cheetos. Like, what's?
Yeah, what makes it an authentic Chicano love poem? That's the question that I had here. What makes it authentic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's titled Authenticity, like, which is one of those words that anytime you hear, oh, it's authentic, it's never authentic. That's immediately where my mind went.
Because you have to be reminded, right? Yeah. So that's always an interesting question. What is authentic? I mean, right off the bat, hot Cheetos is such a big part of like the culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I like this, like, it's almost like a legendary status, right? Like, almost maybe tantamount to being able to open a mazapan without breaking it.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, like a legendary power. Yeah, like, she's so smooth. You know, she. So there's a little bit of humor in that, I think, in that, and we can relate it. It's like an inside joke, because if you don't know, I guess it just kind of goes over your, maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm. It's a fun poem.
It is a fun poem. I love it. Ooh, that's a short section.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I didn't have any more in that section.
No. Mm. I didn't either, but I do like some words look nice until you try them on. Because it really reminds me of, again, like the words versus action. And just a note that I made here was like thoughts of prayers, because that's always like what comes. Mm. Mm-hmm. With, you know, tragic events, but there's not much else that goes with it. So that second half of the poem, I'll never understand how some people meet a drowning person and offer inspirational advice instead of offering a hand or rope.
Oh my gosh.
That just reminded me of that.
I'm going to open up a literary wormhole here again. I mean, illusion. Kyle Tran Myri, a.k.a. Guante, big time poet out of Minneapolis, has a poem called Quicksand that literally kind of talks about the same way, right? Mm-hmm. Where the premise is the speaker of the poem comes across a person singing in quicksand, and he kind of goes through the stages too, right? Instead of offering a rope, he's like, you know, hey, you know, did you do this on purpose? Or like, what were you wearing? You know, like, and then he goes to like, you know, I'm an ally, you know, I'm going to make sure people know about this injustice of you falling in quicksand. Mm. And he kind of goes down, the person keeps sinking and sinking till the end. He's like, ah, I wish I could have done more. Mm-hmm. All I have is this backpack, you know, full of paper and pens and rope. And it's like very on the nose. Like, this is like a condensed version of that.
Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the anti-capitalist view in the philosophy in the poem, in the collection,
mm-hmm.
you know, because these are material needs that people have that could be solved with, you know, material resources, as opposed to like platitudes or like, you know, just words, right? Like a lot of rhetoric out there doesn't really solve issues.
Yeah. I mean, it becomes empty.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. All right. So I think that's the end of our first section.
I think so. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Literally Literary, recorded at Power of the Past and brought to you by Border Census. This episode, we began our discussion on Promises of Gold by Jose Olivares. If you haven't read it, we hope we inspire you to pick up a copy. Join us on our next episode and follow us on Instagram at literallyliterary.ep.